You're listening to the Saturday selection on Monocle 24, highlights from the weekend edition. Hello and welcome to the Saturday selection, the best of the weekend edition on Monocle 24, with me, Georgina Godwin. This week we meet a British crime writer whose books provided the backbone for a detective TV show that's enjoyed huge success from audiences in the US, Australia, New Zealand and here in Britain.
The creative industries bring in £8 million an hour to the UK. And so if we don't cherish and encourage writing, inspiration, creative thought, we're not just damaging the soul of our country, we're damaging its economy as well.
Also ahead.
We managed to cook up a project where we were going to reimagine, reinvent, and renovate all of the 600 school libraries for primary schools in New York City.
American writer and producer Jonathan Levi shares some hugely exciting projects he's worked on. Plus, we meet Monique Roffey, author of a fictional book that tells the story of Trinidad's 1990 coup d'etat.
You know, I don't want to glamorise a gunman, but at the same time, the facts are that he was, you know, unparented, taken from prison, then set free with a gun, half-educated, radicalised, and he shot the place up and he shot someone.
That's on the Saturday selection, a collection of highlights from the weekend edition with me, Georgina Godwin. First, we meet Anne Cleves, a British author who's written a huge number of novels that have collected prizes and critical acclaim. Cleves is probably best known for writing the Vera Stanhope books, which have been dramatised as the hugely successful worldwide TV detective series Vera.
Youngish white male, 7 stab wounds, 6-inch blade.
And?
It's fair to say the killer's new to this game.
So the bus is on a slip road heading back into town. He's fatally wounded on the bridge. So how does he end up in a skip outside Portsmouth?
I was delighted to invite Anne into the studio here at Midori House to discuss her career as one of Britain's finest crime writers. I started the conversation by asking her how she came to have a female lead in her hit series, Vera.
She came about quite by chance. I was writing a big standalone psychological novel. I wasn't expecting it to have a detective in it. But about halfway through, I was really stuck with the plot. I never plot in advance, and I wasn't sure where the story was going to go. And Raymond Chandler said, if you're stuck with a novel, have a door burst open and a guy come through with a gun. I don't really do guns, but it seemed a good trick to just have somebody come through the door and see who it was. And who came in was Vera Stanhope, who was middle-aged, overweight, looking more like a bag lady than a detective. And I really loved writing about her right from the start. So that's where she appeared.
Now, it's interesting that you say you don't really do guns because you don't really do violence very much at all, which is unusual in that genre.
Yeah, I suppose I hark back to the British tradition of Golden Age murder mysteries where the murder itself isn't as important as who did it and why they did it. And I think why they did it is much more interesting than details about hitting somebody over the head with a poker or stabbing them.
Do you think the fact that Vera is a woman that many women can identify with, in that she's not a model or superhuman in any way, accounts somewhat for the popularity of crime fiction amongst women readers?
I think so. I think when I started writing Vera, after she'd appeared to me, I wanted an antidote to those, even the great novels that I enjoy, who have central female characters. They might not be drop-dead gorgeous, but they can always get a man and they can run. And Vera doesn't do any of those things, certainly not in the books. She runs in the TV show. And I suppose I'm thinking back to when I was growing up, because I was born in the mid-50s, and there were lots of strong spinsters then who'd lost men in the war, who hadn't married because the war had got in the way. And they were hospital matrons or they were school teachers or librarians. And they wore dreadful tweed skirts and had thick stockings and flat shoes, but were really, really good at what they did and commanded authority because they were competent rather than the way they looked. And all these years later, after feminism, we still criticise our politicians and people in authority if they're women because they don't look very good. And so Vera is a bit of an antidote to that.
You mentioned that she runs in the television series, but not in the books. And of course, every book that you've written, I think, bar one, has been televised. Yeah. How different are the scripts from the novels?
I think the plotting is very different because film is a different medium. The script writers know exactly what they're doing. The directors then put their stamp on it and the actors have their influence too. So they are very different. I think what the TV does beautifully is reflect the place because it's all filmed in Northumberland. People come up and spend 4 months every year to do the filming. And I think the character of Vera reflecting that place as rugged, independent, a bit quirky, shines out of it, played beautifully by Brenda Blethyn.
And Northumberland, of course, is your home, which is one of the reasons you write about it. Has it changed the place? Are there TV crime fans who come and hang out there?
I don't know. I'd love to think that it brought tourists to the area. It's so beautiful and there's lots of space, so we can accommodate a few more people without it being spoilt by visitors. So I do hope that people will come and appreciate the beauty of the place for themselves.
Now, Vera's not the only thing that you write. You have the whole Shetland series, was originally books that you did. Tell me about that.
Yes, I love Shetland. I first went to Shetland in the mid-70s. I dropped out of university and quite by chance, a chance meeting in a pub in London, got offered a job as assistant cook in the Bird Observatory in Fair Isle. And Fair Isle's one of the Shetland group. And it's the most remote inhabited island in the UK. And I got there, fell madly in love with the place, met my husband there, and have been visiting ever since. And that's nearly 40 years ago.
And we're going to take a break now and listen to perhaps some music from Shetland. I don't know if there's anything from there that particularly inspires you.
Oh, there's a wonderful fiddle player called Chris Stout, who's a Fair Islander, and he's part of Fiddler's Bid, and their music just takes me straight back to Shetland.
So that was the wonderful fiddler Chris Stout from Shetland. And Shetland, of course, is one of the series that you've written for television, although you actually write the novels rather than the TV scripts.
Right.
It's enormously popular. And as a genre, crime fiction is on the up and up. There have been various surveys recently, haven't there?
I'm not sure whether I think crime fiction has always been hugely popular. And I think people love it because it has a resolution. It has an ending. It's strong storytelling. And especially when times are tough, I think, people like a sense that good will triumph in the end. And I think even in contemporary crime fiction, you don't have the baddie being carried away in handcuffs anymore. But there is a sense of somehow of order being restored. And at a time of change and problems and difficulty, I think people enjoy that.
Now, you're appearing at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival this weekend.
Yeah, fantastic festival.
And that's all of these crime writers from all over turn up together.
I mean,
you almost want a murder to take place, I imagine.
Well, we're not quite doing a murder, but we are doing a murder mystery dinner on the Saturday night. And I've been involved in the festival since it started. I started off as reader in residence there, just wanting to put readers at the heart of the festival, because most literature festivals look after their writers very nicely and they have a lovely green room and they spoil them. But actually, it's the readers who pay our wages. They're the people who buy the books and turn out and support us. So right from the start at Harrogate, we wanted to put readers at the centre of the festival. So on Saturday night, we do a big dinner for readers and each table is hosted by a writer, so they get a chance to meet writers. And this year, we're launching the 24-24 challenge there. And that takes me back to Shetland, to the North Isles.
Tell us about that, because I know you're trying to visit as many as possible within a very short space of time.
Yes, this is a celebration of reading and libraries. I'm passionate about libraries. I think we need to sustain them and cherish them, and because they're where we will get our new writers for the future. And so, yes, to celebrate libraries, we are challenging ourselves to do 24 reading events in 24, or more than that in the number of reading events, but to hit 24 islands in Orkney and Shetland in 24 hours. So that means chartering little planes and going on boats and wonderful, amazing events taking place throughout Orkney and Shetland. We're launching it at Harrogate, because that's a sensible place to launch it, by doing this murder mystery dinner. which is called Murder at the Ravenswick Hotel. And it's a Jimmy Perez-inspired mystery.
And Jimmy Perez, of course, the lead in your Shetland series.
In the Shetland books. It's set in Shetland. And this script, after we've done it in Harrogate, will be available to any library throughout the UK who wants to do it, wants to use it. And we hope they'll do it over the 24 hours when we're bombing around Orkney and Shetland trying to do lots of reading events.
Why are libraries still important when we can access books electronically now or simply buy them from a retailer named after a major river, Orinoco, I think perhaps that was?
Because not everybody can afford to buy books still. I live very close to Newcastle. There are some wards in Newcastle that are the most deprived in the UK. There are people there who really can't afford to buy books. They certainly can't afford to get a Kindle. They don't have computers in their homes. So the only access to any form of arts that some people have is their local library. And instead of shutting them, I think we need to be making them art centres for communities. So yeah, let's have books there and let's help people sign on online there, but let's have choirs and let's have wonderful art on the walls and teach drama. A big point that I think gets overlooked in this country is that the creative industries bring in £8 million an hour to the UK. And so if we don't cherish and encourage writing, inspiration, creative thought, we're not just damaging the soul of our country, we're damaging its economy as well.
And not just its local economy. I mean, because your stories are exported worldwide, really,
that's
aren't
right.
they?
Yeah.
Tell me then about comparing, for instance, Scandi Noir, which is obviously a huge genre at the moment, but really quite violent.
Yeah, not all of it is. Like, some of it is very violent, but there are some great Scandi books that are quieter and more domestic and more psychological too. So I think, because a couple of the Scandis have been really popular, the press and maybe readers too seem to think that that's all that Scandi is. But there are some great writers who write quieter things. Mm.
Do you ever feel a sense of responsibility? Are you perhaps giving people with a criminal intent some sort of idea of what they might do?
No, because this is fiction. And especially stories like mine are much more about families and about relationships and about people growing out of the place where they were born. Hidden secrets that go back generations, sort of psychological archaeology, I suppose, than it is about giving someone a lesson in going out and committing murder.
And that was Anne Cleves. After the break, we'll hear from American writer, producer and musician Jonathan Levi.
Indigo and lavender are the ingredients for success for two entrepreneurs based in Wales. We travel through Valley and Dale to meet a jeans maker and a lavender farmer getting it right.
It turned out, you know, everybody loved to come and actually see lavender oil being distilled right here in Wales. So somehow there's a holistic thing going on here that's about the lavender, about distilling, and about a way of life in these hills.
Made in Wales, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
That was Michrag by 10 Martian Boys and Jonathan Levi, who is my guest in the studio, who wrote that piece of music, performed that piece of music, but is so much more than a musician or a writer or a producer. He's American, but he's passing through London and he's here to talk to me today. Jonathan, welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks very much, Georgina.
Let's just start talking about that piece of music, because I think it gives us quite a good introduction point to your career in that it brings together many of the things that you're interested in.
Well, I mean, the title itself refers to the niche that the imam preaches from in a mosque. And as the grandson of two rabbis, it's not something that I had direct encounters with as a child. But as I started to investigate things having to do with not only my Jewish past, but as I started to write about things having to do with the history of the Jews, I found the intersection with the history of Islamic culture to be very potent, especially in Spain. And that's something that throughout my career has been an obsession and has poked my mind in various ways.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of that career, because I know that you started off playing violin and, in fact, even recorded. You were playing in bars and restaurants and then did some recordings too.
That's right. I started violin as a young kid because everyone around me was playing piano and I wanted something portable, which didn't serve me in good stead years later when my violin was nicked. But yeah, early on in university times, I started playing around with various groups because I found that that was kind of fun and it was a good way to meet girls and make a little bit of pocket change, and started playing in bars in Nantucket and out in Denver, Colorado. I went out with one band out there and played something like 40 concerts in 20 days, just wherever we could. And finally, when I came over to university for a couple of years in England, came upon a group of very, very talented people who then went on and had very good careers, and occasionally I got to play with them as well.
Now, when you were at Cambridge, you were also hugely instrumental in beginning Granta, which is, of course, the magazine of new writing, still going on today, and you served as its American editor.
Yeah, I mean, no one is more surprised than I am that it's still going on today, given its start that we had. But yeah, I was one of three people, another American, Bill Buford, and an English guy named Pete DiBala, who were asked to do an American issue for what was a 16-page mimeographed magazine on American writing. And we did, of course, what most Americans do, which is lie. We wrote letters to 25 different American authors who weren't being published in England at the time, Susan Sontag, Donald Barthelme, people of that ilk, and promised them half the issue if they would send us something new. And 19 of them responded. So we had to have 19 halves of an issue, which had its challenges.
I can imagine. And as you say, extraordinary that it's still going strong and has mutated really into a kind of other beast, but still highlighting new writing.
It's remarkable. And I've enjoyed it over the years as Ian Jack, and most recently John Freeman took it over. And now Sigrid Rousing, who is a remarkable woman in many, many different types of fields, is trying a little bit of a different tack with guest editors there. You know, it's terrific. It's, you know, I feel a little bit too young to be a grandfather, but I'm, you know, very pleased that it's going in these very different directions.
Mm. Well, speaking of new writing, you, of course, are a writer yourself, as well as a critic. Before we get on to your writing, I'd like to look at your music writing, because I want to play a track that you actually composed. Tell me about Twilight Barking.
Well, Twilight Barking is a piece that I wrote with a guitarist named John Hushman, who is half Iranian, who was also at Yale University with me. And we had a band called East River at the time, three of us, two guitars and a violin. And John used to come to me with a variety of different types of guitar licks in the background. And this is one where, one of the earliest ones, where I put a tune on top of it. I think I was 18 at the time. So at 18, you're perhaps a little bit closer to movies like 101 Dalmatians than you are to Apocalypse Now, and that's where we took the title and called this piece Twilight Barking.
That was Twilight Barking, and it was written and performed by my guest, who is Jonathan Levi, who is a producer, a musician, obviously, and a writer. And one of the things you've written is A Guide for the Perplexed, a book which has garnered fantastic reviews. It's been described as a mix between the outrageous satire of Monty Python and the globe-trotting of Vanity Fair. Tell me about the book.
Well, it's a book that I never thought I would write. And when I was working on Granta, when I was working as an editor, you think to yourself, well, writing is, of course, nothing that you yourself are going to do. But after I left Granta, I thought, well, you know, I've got, you know, a few things that are obsessing me. And One of them had to do with my own sort of discovery of, I suppose, Jewish culture. Even though I came from a Jewish family, I'm the grandson of two rabbis, I never was a practicing Jew at all, and I didn't know quite how to get a handle on it. I was no fan of Israeli politics, and I had been told by my family after I had been there during just before the Six-Day War, I had been there just before the Yom Kippur War, I had been essentially told to stay away from Israel, that I was not good for the country. But I started to read into a wonderful book called The Legends of the Jews by a guy named Louis Ginzburg around the turn of the 20th century. And I found through the tales, the fables that tried to explain all this sort of interstitial stuff that the Bible, that the Old Testament doesn't explain, that there were a lot of pretty cool legends and a lot of myths that happened through there. And I had also combined that with an experience that happened to me back in 1978 when I first went to Spain and was on my way back to visit my girlfriend in England when all of a sudden I was stranded in Madrid by a blizzard in England and a wildcat strike in Madrid and was thrown out into the streets. And so I figured, well, those are two, you know, disparate types of ideas. Maybe I can get a novel out of that. And that's where Guide for the Perplexed came from.
Before we continue, I'd like to just to hear a piece of opera that you have written.
Mm. This is a piece from an opera that I wrote with Mel Marvin called Guest from the Future. And it tells a story that I had heard about because I'm the son of a philosopher, but I'm also the son-in-law of an English businessman who was very close to Isaiah Berlin. And so I knew Berlin when I was both a child and when I was a little bit older. And I had heard the story about how the philosopher from Oxford and diplomat for Winston Churchill during the Second World War had in 1945 gone to Russia, had asked to be sent there. And while piecing through a bookstore in Leningrad, had been asked by somebody if he would like to meet a living author and went to meet Anna Akhmatova, the famous poet, whom he thought, in fact, had been dead. But he was taken to her flat at about 3:30 in the afternoon, and he met her. She was 55 at the time. He was 35. And all we know for certain is that he didn't come out again until 11 the next morning. However, we also know that after that, she wrote some of her greatest love poetry. We know that he went back to the Astoria Hotel and said, I'm in love. And that Stalin's secret police had seen him leave her flat. And so she became persona non grata. Her son was sent to the gulag. She wasn't published until well into Khrushchev's time. And a few weeks later, Winston Churchill gave his famous Iron Curtain speech. So she, in fact, said the Cold War started that night. So Mel Marvin and I wrote an opera about that night, about what happened in that flat. And this is an aria that Anna sings to Isaiah to explain who she is.
Michaela Martin singing the aria from Guest from the Future, which is written by my guest, who is Jonathan Levi. He's here in the studio with me, and we're still talking opera. New opera for new ears.
That was an idea that I had, another idea for the Metropolitan Opera Guild. And the idea was that opera, as we all see, is having a hell of a time getting young audiences in there. And so my thought was, how can we somehow get new ears, in other words, anyone under the age of about 50 who hasn't been educated in opera, into the opera. And so I approached a sort of an A-list of 10 top pop composers with the idea of getting them to compose operas, people who I felt had a very strong narrative feel, people like Paul McCartney, David Byrne, Elton John, and a whole list. And two of those people responded to my plea. One was Frank Zappa, who opened up his conversation on the phone by saying, I think it's only fair to tell you that I broke off negotiations with the London Symphony Orchestra at $2 million. And I said, well, that was nice that you told me that. Let's keep talking. And he was a charming, lovely guy, but nothing ever happened. But I had a few hours of conversation with Frank Zappa, which was great. Right. And the other one who was very interested was Elvis Costello. And I went and saw Elvis, and he had a fabulous idea for an opera. But for one reason or another, essentially because the Metropolitan Opera couldn't really sort of hear his music past his performance, we decided to go a different way. And I worked with Carly Simon for about 2 years, and she wrote an opera called Romulus Hunt, which, as she told me at one point, for those of your listeners who don't know, she was at one point known as Mrs. James Taylor, that I walked in for one of our composing sessions, and James was there, and she said, we're writing the third act of the opera. And it was really all about her split with James Taylor, which, you know, from a marketing point of view, meant that it appealed to children, it appealed to adults, and it appealed to post-adults as well. So it had a good run. It played in New York, and it played at the Kennedy Center, and it's been revived a number of times. So it's something that Carly, I think, is very pleased with, and I'm very pleased as well that we did that.
Jonathan, you've done so much incredible work, your work at Bard College, also your work with school libraries in New York City. Perhaps we could just touch briefly on both of those.
You know, part of the advantage of living past your 40s into your 50s is your friends get interesting jobs, and sometimes they ask you to come and work with them. And a good friend of mine, Harold Levy, became the chancellor of the public school system in New York, which is 1.1 million school children, 70,000 teachers. I mean, huge numbers of stuff to play with. And Harold asked me to come in as sort of his right-hand man, essentially the one who would tell him when he was messing up. I also took on the brief of arts and culture. And one of the things that I, of course, as a writer, as an editor, that I was passionate about was libraries. And so I sort of started rooting around and found that there was a very quirky young woman named Lonnie Tanner who was working with the Robin Hood Foundation, which was a private organization. I mean, in the United States, we really can't do much unless we get partnerships with private organizations because the government gives basically nothing to culture. And Robin Hood Foundation was a bunch of suits who felt that they wanted to give back some of the largesse that they had made on Wall Street through various projects. And we managed to cook up a project where we were going to reimagine, reinvent, and renovate all of the 600 school libraries for primary schools in New York City. And we put together a group of young architects that were willing to work pro bono. We started a new library school to train these new librarians because it was not just a question of books, it was a question of digital technology. We got a variety of graphic artists to reimagine how a library could be, a bunch of educational experts to think of the library as really being sort of the brain of a school, the central part of the school, not just a place where kids go and are supposed to be quiet and read a book, but where they go and they can work on projects together. And it was a tremendously fascinating challenge, because it also meant trying to use public money with private money in a way that was responsible, which is not always the easiest thing to do.
Now, in terms of collaboration, this is something that you achieve very much so within the performing arts program at Bard, which you set up.
That came directly out of my work in the public schools, because when I left the public schools, I had told Harold I would come work for him for 3 months, and I stayed for 2 years. But when I left, I was leaving to go back to my own writing. But I had run into another genius, another very quirky genius named Leon Botstein, who was not only the president of Bard College, but the conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra. He had a new idea for a new type of school where college professors would teach the last couple of years of high school. And within a week, I had introduced him to Harold, and we had decided to start the school, and we opened the school 3 months later. And he thought that was a good thing. So when I left the Board of Education, he had a project that was sort of up and running, in which he had gotten Frank Gehry, the architect, to design a new performing arts center up at Bard College, which is 2 hours north of New York in the middle of nowhere. Beautiful, beautiful campus, but not a metropolitan area. It was going up, and he didn't really know what to do with it. And he asked me if I would come up and work on that and get it going. And even though I wanted to get back and get back to writing, it was too much of a golden opportunity. So I went up there. I told him I would give him 3 years. I gave him 3 years, which were some of the most fascinating years of my life.
You brought in performers from all over the world, didn't you?
No, we did. I mean, for our first opera that we did there, we did an unknown Janáček opera called Osud. Frank, in fact, designed the sets for that, but we brought in Czech musicians for that. I brought in Russian theaters and directors who hadn't been seen in the United States, who were doing theatrical work that was related to the opera Kamaginkas, Valery Fokin and the Alexandrinsky Theater from St. Petersburg, puppet theater from the Czech Republic. And a wonderful, one of my favorite imports was a violinist singer named Eva Bitova, who was Václav Havel's favorite performer back in the Czech Republic. And she would play violin and sing a sort of eerie, gypsy-tinged type of stuff. And along with a wonderful director named David Chambers, we went over to Brno, where she lived, and we convinced her to come back on stage for the first time in 20 years and perform the part of Donna Elvira in a wild and wacky version of Don Giovanni that we called Don Juan in Prague, which then went over and played in Prague itself and came back and played the Brooklyn Academy of Music later on. So it was a lot of fun.
I want to talk about your political work in the form of opera, actually. And we're going to hear a piece of music from Eden. Just to tell me about it.
Well, Eden is another collaboration with Mel Marvin. Mel, who wrote the Guest from the Future about Akhmatov and Isaiah Berlin with me, that was the first opera he had ever written. He has had 7 musicals on Broadway. He's known as a Broadway composer of works like Tintypes, Elmer Gantry, History of the American Film. So I had always wanted for years and years to work and to write a musical with him. But my idea of musicals, I suppose, go back to Brecht and Weill, you know, more than they go back to Candor and Ebb or, you know, to The Sound of Music. Mm. When I was working with Mel and we were coming up with an idea for a musical, I came up with something that didn't really seem like the all-singing, all-dancing Broadway musical, which was the idea of writing something about Hurricane Katrina. Mostly because Mel and I both had daughters who were in university at the time and had gone down right after Katrina and had done some relief work down there and came back with stories that were beyond imagining. So we started writing this this piece, Eden, and at the same time there was this little thing going on a little further to the east called the war in Iraq that was troubling many of us, not just me. And I saw many similarities in terms of, shall we say, the American ability to deal with disaster was perhaps not what we imagined, you know, our country could deal with. And so these two things combined together, and we wrote a musical called Eden. This piece that you're going to hear is called Shock and Awe, and it's sung by a young son of New Orleans who comes back to do the disaster relief in New Orleans, but leaves behind him an Iraqi girlfriend who he had met while he was over there with the Marines as part of the Shock and Awe campaign that went in and first took over Baghdad.
Shock and Awe from Eden.
Rashid wipes the mud from the lids of a newborn's eyes. We turn the prow to the west, loaded down to the gills, stuff our ears to the fading cries. But when Siren throws her songs out to me, Baghdad, turn back for me. So lullaby, body in the treetops. When the bombs fall, your wheelchair will rock. Rip off your veil and swim across the sea. Swim and save me. Swim and save me. Break down the levee, bring on the flood, save the whole world, bomb them back.
That was Shock and Awe from Eden, written by my guest, Jonathan Levi, who is multi-talented, has done so many different things. You've written a play, Falling Bodies, you've written many short stories. I love the Scrimshaw violin, which you then turned into an opera. But now you split your time between New York and Rome. Tell me about your Rome hat, if you like.
Well, Rome is a wonderful place now. My wife and I have lived in Rome now for the last 10 years, which has in a way, enabled me to play around with friends on this side of the ocean quite a bit in terms of artistic ventures. Falling Bodies, which you mentioned, a play that I wrote about an imagined meeting between Galileo and Primo Levi, I got an invitation through friends of friends to direct that at the National Theater of Georgia in Tbilisi, well, which from Rome is only 5 hours by plane. From New York, you would never have thought of doing something of this sort. I've been able to work with friends with opera in the Netherlands. I work currently with a wonderful impresario in Lucerne, the head of the Lucerne Symphony Orchestra, on a Russian music festival. So being in Rome allows me to do those sort of things.
Jonathan, to end, I want to go right back to where we started. We were talking about your book, which has lots of elements of magic realism in it. And so I want to talk about your work with the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Prize in Cartagena in Colombia.
Well, I've gone to Cartagena for over 20 years. I went just by accident with my brother-in-law for the first time. And the second time I went, I was invited to be a judge in the Miss Columbia Beauty Pageant. And so I've returned many times since then. And in the course of that time, I met the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Foundation, which Garcia Marquez started with some of his Nobel Prize money, which is dedicated to pushing journalism forward in South America. And in the last 2 years, this will be our third year coming up, we've run a fellowship for mid-career cultural journalists in music, in film, in literature. This year, we'll be doing a seminar in association with the Hay Festival, which will be celebrating its 10th anniversary in Cartagena with one of its satellite festivals there, a great festival. And we invite journalists from all over the world to apply who already have a career going, but whose career might be advanced by meeting other people from all over the world and seeing a little bit of this continent that many of them, you know only through the work of Garcia Marquez.
Jonathan, there's so much more to talk about. Sadly, we're out of time. Incredibly talented man with such a brilliant ongoing career. If I could ask you to give us one last piece of music to play out with something that perhaps, rather as Mishrab set us up at the beginning, perhaps sums up your career.
This is a piece, another piece from Eden, that is sung by the girlfriend of the young son of New Orleans that I mentioned before. And she is a curator at the Iraqi National Museum. And she sings this song while she's in Baghdad being left behind by her boyfriend, Jamie. And it's called Auf Laila wa Laila, which means 1001 Nights. It's the name of Arabian Nights. And it's her way of somehow making sense of these different cultures, these different worlds, the world of the United States, the world of Baghdad, the world of literature in general. And I suppose if that's, you know, a common theme in my life, the thing that I've been lucky enough to be able to follow from one project to another, it's trying to make sense of all these different wonderful parts of what we call the earth.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and making sense of it all for us here at Monocle 24. That's my guest, Jonathan Levi.
Just an ordinary girl who lived in a hurricane. Let the wind become her world.
Of Leila Wa Leila, written by Jonathan Levi. Still to come on this episode of the Saturday Selection, highlights from the weekend edition, we meet Monique Roffey, author of a vigorous, grimy, absorbing tale of a bloody Caribbean coup.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luscombe. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week. and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
You're with the Saturday Selection, highlights from Saturday's weekend edition, which airs 8 to 1500 hours London time every week here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. For the final chapter of the show, we meet Monique Roffey, an award-winning Trinidadian-born British writer. House of Ashes, published in June this year, is her most current novel. It's the third in a trilogy of books set in the Caribbean. It draws on a bloody chapter of the country's recent history, the attempted coup of 1990. Here, Monique starts by telling us about those real events that inspired her book.
24 years ago, there was an attempted coup d'etat staged by a small group in Trinidad, and they managed to ship lots of guns into the country and lay siege to Parliament in mid-session on a Friday afternoon, and also the television station. And I think there were about 114 men, and just wreaked havoc for 6 days. You know, shot the Prime Minister, shot other people. In 6 days, they managed to raise Port of Spain to the ground, injure and kill numerous people, and really, really, really rip something open which hadn't ever been torn into in our small republic nation before or since. So it wasn't a successful coup. However, I would say that it was so memorable and so shocking because it wasn't like a popular uprising. It wasn't, I mean, and also most coups come from within side, you know, have military sympathy, whereas this didn't. So there was literally very little sympathy. There weren't many people on board with this coup, unbeknownst to the leaders. So it was a very strange thing to happen in a region where there are marches and revolutions. And, you know, we have Cuba, we have Haiti, we have Grenada, we have all kinds of big revolutions that were backed by people.
And it's something that's not really been written about a lot since then.
Journalists in Trinidad have written eyewitness accounts and sort of non-fiction, but I think it's been a bit of an untouchable for novelists based in Trinidad, and that's very complicated. Sometimes I think something really big blows up in your face. I mean, I know there are writers who've been thinking about writing about it. And then there's the question of it's such a small place that we all know people who were held hostage. And then there's also legal issues. So it hasn't been touched yet. Well, it has now by me, and with much trepidation, yeah.
Because, of course, some of those people are really very dangerous and hate-filled men. So does that make you a little frightened?
Yes, it was a concern. Yeah, it has been a concern, yeah.
But, however, you went ahead and you've produced this fantastic work of fiction, it must be said. You have fictionalised the events that happened there. Now, one of the tools that you used in getting all of this together was having a look at the inquiry, which has finally concluded.
Yeah. Basically, a commission of inquiry was commissioned and set up in 2011 and 2012. 2013, it was still running. The report has just been delivered in March, and incredibly, the Prime Minister at the time died weeks later. You know, it was almost as if he was waiting for the report to be delivered. But so it took about 23 years for this report to be put into action by the current government. Suspiciously long time. Governments since then, you know, you could say have, it's very hard not to, for politicians that revolve in politics, they go in and out of parties' doors. It's very complicated, you know. I think it would have been hard to establish a truly independent inquiry. I think a couple of ex-prime ministers literally had to leave office. I mean, in the book I talk about, you know, I say things, something like an inquiry would have implicated everybody. And it kind of has. And it's not hard to see, you know, years later what happened. So for a long time, I was very, very hesitant about committing to this. But the inquiry was made public. So all the testimonies were online, which is a really, really big gift and a valuable document to citizens of Trinidad and anybody else interested in what happened there or anywhere else. So it did give me a feeling that I could go ahead.
So those are the facts, and that's the situation. In a moment, we'll have a look at how you fictionalise it and what House of Ashes is really about and the fascinating characters that you focus on. First of all, though, I want to hear a piece of music. Now, you've chosen A Madman's Rant by David Rudder. Mm. Tell me a little bit about him.
He's a really, really famous calypsonian in Trinidad.
I love that word, calypsonian. That means someone who sings the calypso?
The notion of the calypso has died a bit in Trinidad, which is a real pity. The calypso grew out of the kind of oral tradition of what we call the chant well, the person who would sing the truth and be a kind of bard and social commentator. And, you know, in the last 20 years, we've seen the demise of what we call the tent, the calypso tent, where it's really interesting because a government wouldn't feel at all threatened by someone like me because I write on the page, you know, but they would be really threatened by the calypsonians of the day. And if a calypsonian chose to go against a party or a prime minister, that was problematic. That was trouble. So, and people would go, and you can't, you know, when you have a strong oral tradition with people singing and critical analysis and singing the truth and undermining people, undermining the government, you know, there's this great human rights kind of activism there because, you know, people can turn up and listen and then disappear, and they've taken the police can't turn up and confiscate anything. There's no literature, there are no pamphlets. Someone just stood up and sung a song, but they will go away with that song. So David Rudder definitely comes from that tradition, and he's still singing those kind of calypsos. Commentary, analysis, criticism.
So this is A Madman's Rant by David Rudder. That was David Rudder and A Madman's Rant. I'm speaking to Monique Roffey, and we're talking about her book, House of Ashes, based on real events, but it is fiction. And you've got some really, really strong characters in there. You've got one young gunman whose character is really, really interesting. And in the book, you look at how culpable he is, how responsible he should be for the events that happen. Mm. He kills somebody he doesn't perhaps mean to at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's the big question for the book, is that I feel as though, yeah, how culpable is he? You know, I don't want to glamorise a gunman or somehow a hero, make him a hero. He's not one of the heroes of the book. But at the same time, the facts are that he was, you know, unparented, taken from prison, parented by, you know, a guru figure, then set free with a gun, half-educated, radicalised, etc., etc. And, you know, and he shot the place up and he shot someone. So that was when he was sort of 15. And, you know, we see this young bad mouth, you know, this bad, bad boy who wants to shoot everything up, and he's cursing his head off and he's full of violence. But he's also somewhat been indoctrinated. You know, he's been more or less adopted by the guru, the man, the leader. So we see him early on in full, you know, and in a way sort of receiving a kind of wounding, a spiritual wounding as well in the house of power. Cut to, we meet him when he's changed his name and he's been in hiding for 23 years. And he comes back and he wants to see the prime minister. And we get this sense that the prime minister is like not letting him off at all. It's like, no, you know, you don't get this, not a happy ending for you. But I wanted to leave it in the hands of the reader to decide if he's innocent. Mm.
Now, one of the really clever devices you use in writing the book is showing us the story through different people's points of view. Mm. And you very cleverly get into the male perspective and write through these men. Now, another one is Ashes, as in House of Ashes, the title. Mm. Tell us about him.
Well, he is loosely based on someone I met who was part of this insurrection. And the man I met was a quiet man, a spiritual man, a man who had clearly a lot of regret and had understood that he'd got something really badly wrong. And a quiet, scholarly, you know, there's a kind of man there. So Ashes is the kind of person. He also has a famous revolutionary brother. So there are elements of truth in that as well. But he gets swept up as a kind of, because of he's got this revolutionary brother, the leader handpicks him to be part of the kind of vanguard of the so-called revolution because he's got kudos. He's River's brother. And he's clearly out of his depth. He gets given a gun, and this is what actually happened. Half of them hadn't been trained. Half of them had never fired a shot, never held a gun. And he gets given a gun and told to storm the building, and that's exactly what he does. And within seconds, he has an out-of-body experience, and he flies up to the ceiling in panic so he's able to watch what's going on. And he gets out of his depth immediately, even though he had checked himself in terms of his moral convictions, and he was purposeful in his intentions for, you know, storming the house, but he just loses that instantly. And then for the rest of the siege, he's just trying to cope in his own way as a human being and to find his spiritual core and to pray and to somehow just get through it. And of course, there's a kind of healing and a surrender for him as well.
You talk about his spiritual side, and there's a passage in there that was really, I think, the most spiritual thing I've ever read. You really illustrated for me what true faith must feel like. Do you have faith yourself?
I'm not sure if I'd use the word faith, but I feel as though I understand what people call the numinous, which is contact with a kind of force which is written about by every single wisdom tradition on the planet, which is the kind of essential life force, the divine force. You know, I meditate and I've been practicing Buddhism on and off for a few years now. So now and again, I experience that feeling that I write about with Ashes, that kind of you open your heart, you open your chest, you open up and it comes.
We're going to hear another piece of music now, another one from David Rudder, this one, 1990.
It is strange. The more we change, the more we rearrange.
That's 1990, it comes from David Rudder, and I'm speaking to Monique Roffey, who is the author of House of Ashes, amongst other works. It's not your first book by any means, is it?
No.
Tell me about some of your other works.
Oh, God. It's my third book set in the Caribbean, in Trinidad and the Caribbean region. All written quite quickly. There was The White Woman on the Green Bicycle, which was published in 2009. Very biographical book about my mum and dad, my parents, you know, sort of colonial immigrants who came 60 years ago, and the process of creolization, the process of how they ended up becoming part of the fabric of society there, and their various ups and downs around the independence era. So that was my first book set in the region. And then 2 years ago, I published Archipelago, which is a journey taken by a little girl and a dog and a man in the aftermath of a flood. And it touches on global warming and issues around, you know, these are people who try to sail away and understand what's happened to them and get perspective. And they sail through various archipelagos and get to the Galapagos, only to face what they've left behind on the other side of the world. So I was with my brother recently watching a cricket match at the Oval, and a Bajan batsman, he batted the ball and the ball went out of the park. It bounced on a building and it just bounced out of the park. And my brother turned to me and he said, you know, there's so much material here. You know, you'll be writing about this place forever. And
yeah. Is that important? I mean, is a sense of place, and in fact, is being in that place actually important when you're writing about it?
Completely crucial and critical now. And I think for a long time I lived in diaspora. I lived outside of the region. For most of my 20s and my 30s, I just stayed away. I was young, you know, wanted to be in a big city. But now that I'm writing about the Caribbean, I now live there 6 months of the year. And I can see myself living there more and more, because you miss so much. You know, if you want to write about a place, live it, live the place, not just live in it, live with it. Live alongside it. It's a restless, unpredictable new world. Developed nation, oil-rich country, diverse, culturally, ethnically diverse. It's a massively complicated and complex place to live. And to live outside it is to miss so much.
Can you write about things? Do you feel that you need to write about that area of the world? Or now that you're here, do you feel inspired, for instance, to do a London novel?
I'll never write a London. Well, I have written, my first novel was set in a delicatessen in London, but there are so many fine English British writers living in London, writing about London, or situated in London, that I'll just leave that to them, I think.
So now we have to hope that you're on your way back to the Caribbean so that we get another book.
Yeah, I hope so too, yeah.
That was Trinidadian-born British writer Monique Roffey, author of House of Ashes. That's all we've got time for on this episode of The Saturday Selection. It was produced and mixed by Claire Urban, with editing assistance from James Bullock, and I'm Georgina Godwin. Join us again to hear some of the very best of the weekend's interviews here on Monocle 24. And of course, you can always listen live every Saturday. If you'd like to drop us a line, please do. Email me at gg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.